who told us, as he told Israel a long time ago, that we can't be part of the Jewish tradition, we can't be part of the Christian tradition, we cannot be followers of Jesus, and also stand by and allow our society to fragment into groups of people who are pitted against one another, because that is not consistent with our tradition. We can't let one group accumulate power and voice and privilege and resources and allow another group to be excluded. Access for one must be access for all. That is part of our tradition. The problem, we discovered early in this lesson, is that that sounds political. And right now, the political environment in our nation is hypercharged. And so if something sounds political, we become subject to the dynamic that if you've been bitten by a snake, you're afraid of a rope. And that is anything that even smacks of political becomes supercharged. Our community is represented by both people who are politically conservative and people who are politically liberal, and Amos sounds liberal. So the folks who align politically liberally say, "Go, Amos, go, yeah, man." And the folks who are politically conservative say, "Well, wait a minute, that seems like we are sneaking political ideology in under the guise of religious sanctity." And so we had to stop and speak about that. And we did, and we spoke about it by addressing six foundations of human morality and recognizing that across the political spectrum, one side of the spectrum tends to internalize very effectively one set of moral foundations, and the other side tends to internalize and begin to make part of their worldview another set of these moral foundations, which means that we need one another. We need to do what our society is doing poorly or not doing at all. We need to be able to listen across the gulf that the left and the right, that separates us left and right. Last week, I talked about how our brains are wired and how our instincts kick in microseconds and how our rational conscious minds kick in seconds. And so I introduced Jonathan Haidt's book and his image of the elephant part of our brain and the rider part of our brain, and to distinguish those two. And I said, our brains form for us built-in obstacles to the spiritual life, built-in obstacles to the spiritual journey, built-in obstacles to the higher life that both Amos and Jesus have called us to move toward, because our brains are disposed to simplistic, soundbite kinds of arguments, because our conscious, our thoughtful, our logical, our executive function parts of our brains are usually not acting, they are usually reacting. In other words, the deeper part of our brain, the instinctive, the microsecond part of our brain moves, formulates a response and a strategy almost immediately, again, microseconds, and then seconds later, our conscious brain begins to formulate narratives to justify, ways of saying, this is why this is a good thought process, this is why. And so, I suggested, we ought to be a little bit suspicious. Suspicious of our narratives and suspicious of our justifications, because they were created in response to instincts. And they don't always tap into the instincts that they respond to very effectively. All of those instincts are rooted in part of human morality we saw, and they're spread across a wide spectrum of people. So we ought to be suspicious. Suspicious of the righteousness of our own cause, and suspicious of the unrighteousness of the other's cause. And sometimes, I said, we need to listen past the arguments, because if you're paying attention to this election season, you realize that very little of what's being talked about is political ideology. We are talking about some craziness right now. We're talking about the size of people's hands. We're talking about stuff that doesn't have anything to do with conservative political ideology or liberal political ideology. So sometimes you have to get past the craziness to get to the instincts that is deeply rooted. So that, I said, is part of what we ought to do. We ought to be suspicious. So we had to take a detour from our lesson on Amos because we had to respond to the toxic soup that our political environment is creating around us. But today I want to return to Amos. I want to talk about yet another way that our brains betray us, another way that the spiritual journey calls us to move beyond, to live beyond our most base instincts. So before we talk about that, let me talk about this first. Let me talk about guilt. There's a good chance that what I'm going to say today is going to evoke an automatic guilt response. There's a good chance that what I'm going to say today is going to bring up guilt the same way that your mouth produces saliva as soon as you smell food. It'll just be autonomic. It'll just happen. Because the topic that I'm going to bring up today tends to evoke guilt that way. And when guilt shows up, being unpleasant as it is, we tend to have some very well-rehearsed defense strategies built into our lives to help us not have to feel those bad feelings. Sometimes, to help us avoid having to feel those bad feelings, our brains will go into blaming mode. In other words, we will blame someone else for the thing so that we don't have to feel the guilt, so that we don't have to feel the bad feeling. Sometimes our brains go into justification mode, which is we go and we argue with ourselves and we tell ourselves why we don't have to feel guilty about this thing after all. Sometimes we go into medication mode, which is I'm going to go think some happy thoughts about some happy plans that I've got to do or some to-do lists that I've got to take care of or some job. I'm going to go think about something else so that I don't have to think about these bad feelings that come up. But whatever they do, our brains are nothing if not clever. And so they will help us have to avoid this. And so there's a very good chance while I'm talking, your brain will jump onto a train and that train will go down the path of blaming or of justifying or of medicating one of those things. So we've got these established patterns cleverly devised over countless episodes to help us avoid our unpleasant thoughts. And guilt is an unpleasant thought. So my invitation today is to do a little bit of extra work. The work of standing outside of any of those afflictive emotions that arise. To observe them, but not get caught up in them. To see the train, but not jump on it. To feel the feeling, name the feeling, but don't become the feeling. Stand outside of it and sense it, name it, but don't be it. So that's a little bit of extra work I'm going to ask of you today. And the kind of guilt that I might evoke today is a specialized form of guilt. It is rich guilt. It is wealthy guilt. It is affluence guilt. It is prosperous guilt. And I might just by saying that have already produced some feelings. But here's the thing. We are rich. We live in a rich part of the country, and we live in one of the richest countries in the world. And rich folks are easy targets for guilt. Now, you might be thinking to yourself, phew, I dodged a bullet there because I'm not rich. But hold on, here are some numbers. These are the average household incomes in just a few zip codes that are nearby where we are. In 27614, the average household income is $124,000. 27615, $104,000. 27613, $102,000. 12 is $95,000. '09 is $86,000, '04 is $61,000. In Wake County in general, the average household income is $88,000. In Raleigh itself, in the city limits, it's $76,000. Now, that compared to the United States is pretty high because the average household income in the United States is $52,000. And that compared worldwide is particularly wealthy because the average household income in the whole world is $10,000 per year. Now, I have not mentioned Amos, and I have not mentioned Jesus, and I wouldn't be surprised if some of those feelings are already coming up. Because though we haven't mentioned starving people, or sweatshops, or diseased water sources, just the numbers are often enough to evoke rich guilt and the strategies that we use to avoid the bad feelings that come with rich guilt. But if I were to mention Jesus, yeah, that's not even going to help. That's just going to make it worse. Listen to what Jesus says. It's easier for a camel to get through the eye of a needle than for someone rich to enter into the kingdom of God. And that little gem has been around long enough that you've probably heard it. And you've probably got that somewhere internalized in your guts. And so if Jesus doesn't make you feel rich guilt, well, then who is going to make us feel rich guilt? Because even the poorest of us are rich. if not by Wake County standards, well, odds are you're doing pretty well by U.S. standards. And if you're not doing well by U.S. standards, odds are you're doing pretty well by world standards. So here we are, rich. And then there's guilt. And we could do that. We can do guilt. And we can do all the interior gymnastics that we do when afflictive emotions come up, and we can jump through all of those hoops if we'd like to. We can blame, and we can justify, and we can mount a well-rehearsed argument interiorly and externally. We can medicate. We can do all that. Or maybe we can try for something better. Maybe we could try for self-awareness. We could try to understand what goes on inside of us that Jesus was talking about. Try to understand what goes on inside of us that Amos was challenging in our lives. So let me talk again about some interior brain traps. And let's see if we can't figure out a better way around this than just defaulting to rich guilt and all of the things that go with it. So the last couple weeks, I've mentioned a book by Daniel Goleman. The title was Focus. And he tells us a little bit about how our brains work. We've got these axons and these dendrites. They're the nerve endings in our brains. And if we use them, it turns out we strengthen them. And if we don't use them, it turns out we weaken them, and eventually we will lose them. I use the phrase to talk about the wiring of our brains, use it or lose it. If you don't use a function, you will eventually lose the capacity that goes with that function. Well, Goleman helps us understand Amos and helps us understand Jesus, because it turns out that poor people have developed one part of the brain, rich people have developed another. Poor people have atrophied one part of the brain, and rich people have atrophied another. Because it turns out that poor people tend to be more helpful to other people than rich people do. And it turns out that poor people tend to give a larger percentage of their income to other people than rich people do. And those statistics don't happen because rich people are just bad and poor people are good. They happen because of the way that our brains are wired. It's a natural default instinct into which we fall. Now remember, if guilt starts kicking in, observe it, feel it, don't become it. So it's a thing. Poor people are more generous by percentage. So the question then becomes, are rich people just bad? Is it that Jesus was saying with that whole camels and needles thing, rich people are just horrible. They're just bad people. If it is, living in the zip codes that we live in, we're kind of screwed. So maybe not. I think Jesus was observing what neurobiologists are now explaining. It's another way that our brains can betray us. So another instance of how the spiritual journey is inviting us to rise above the more base instincts, the default mechanisms in our heads. Well, it's even worse than the poor being more generous than the rich. Wealthy people tend to be less empathetic in general. Because of that use it or lose it function that goes on inside of our brains, wealthy people don't need other people as much as poor people do. Poor people need other people. Poor people need them more than rich people need them. Poor people need community more than rich people do. Poor people need to give favors and then have those favors reciprocated as a matter of life more than rich people do. Poor people do not have the independent resources or the resources that allow them to be as independent as rich people do. So, as we become wealthier, we tend to use the part of our brains that connects with other people in an interdependent way less frequently. As we become able to afford more independence, we become more independent. And that, in turn, strengthens our independent neurons, but it actually ends up weakening our interdependent neurons. And a lot of the skill sets that go with interdependence, we end up allowing them to atrophy in our lives. So we weaken some and we strengthen others. When we don't use our independence skills, we lose. When we don't use our interdependence skills, we lose our interdependence skills. And it turns out that the part of our brain that practices empathy tends to become less active the wealthier we become. Now, I don't suspect that the spiritual tradition is telling us that we should be poor. I suspect what the spiritual tradition is telling us is that we shouldn't let our brains betray us. Now, it might be that we make choices because of the spiritual tradition about what we do with our wealth that would be different. But I think what is at the base of this is not allowing our brains to go to that default place that they will go and us losing out in the process. So that's the purpose of religion. Again, to elevate us beyond the go-to default instincts, the more base patterns of our brains. Now, given the zip codes that we tend to live in, neural studies are not in our favor. As we get wealthier, we become less empathetic. As we get wealthier, we lose some of the natural capacity and the skills to express empathy. We also become less capable of simple things like reading facial cues. Turns out our capacity to acknowledge and recognize when another person is in discomfort or suffering, or put ourselves and feel the feelings of another person going through a difficulty, we lose some of that capacity in something as practical as reading facial cues. We don't have to practice our empathetic skills as frequently when we are independent, when we have the resources not to, because we don't need them as frequently, and so we don't use them, and again, we lose them. Over time, neurobiologists are telling us, our brains lose the ability for face cue reading and attention paying and putting ourselves into the position of other people, and it becomes harder for us to imagine ourselves in the position of another person with any degree of accuracy. There was a story in Goleman's book that illustrates this. A group was formed by some psychologists across the power differential divide. In other words, there was a group of migrant workers and there were a group of middle-class Americans. And they gathered into one group for the purpose of telling one another stories about their lives. The format was very simple, that they would gather, they would tell the stories of one another's lives, and then the person who was across the divide would stand and speak to the group and tell the other person's story for them. So, on this day, there was a migrant worker who told one of his stories. It was the story of a lady who, after a day's work, refused to pay him. And for him, given his financial situation, to lose a day's labor was a really big deal. And so he told the story of his circumstance. Then she stood up in front of the group and told the story to the broader group, and she failed epically. She wasn't able to factor into his story how it works when an undocumented worker tries to stand up for his rights. She got the story very wrong, and she got it wrong in a very public setting. And the author said, as he was watching this group unfold, he saw the man whose story it was standing off to the side and weeping quietly. Because this woman misreading his story was just one more in a whole string of interactions that he'd had with people, enforcing and enforcing and reinforcing and reinforcing his own invisibility, a steady flow of people for whom he was not seen. And this story surfaced for him just how pronounced that was. And what had happened was that the storyteller imagined herself in his position, but in her imagining, she couldn't really see what it was like to be in his position. She couldn't feel what it was like not to have citizen rights because she was so deeply entrenched in her own citizenship. She couldn't see and she couldn't hear and she couldn't even consider how to tell his story through the lens of his powerlessness. And consequently, she distorted his story. And consequently, he wept for his invisibility. Now, the warning that Jesus gave us foresaw what neuroscience is now telling us, that the challenge of Amos, the teaching of Jesus, is that when you have more resources, your brains are going to adapt. When you have more resources, your brains are going to adapt. You're going to be less able to see others around you. We're going to lose focus when this happens. We're going to lose insight. We will not be able to pay as much attention to others because our brains are simply wired to use those skills or lose those skills. So we find ourselves unable to empathize as accurately with others as we could when we were in the situation where we had to use those on a regular basis. It turns out that the part of our brain that lights up when we pay attention is the same part of our brain that lights up when we empathize. There is something about the ability to pay attention to the condition of another person that is connected to empathy. And it turns out that the part of our brain that lights up when both of those is the same part of our brain that is related to love. The more that we can put ourselves in another person's position, the greater our capacity to express love. The more that we can feel what it feels like to be in another person's place, see what it means to be in another person's position, the more we are capable of following the greatest commandment that Jesus gave to us, to love our neighbors. The better we can put ourselves in another's place, the more we can empathize with another, the greater our capacity for love and the greater our capacity to become followers of Jesus. When we have resources that allow us to behave independently, we don't have to rely on others as much. And the part of our brain that does that empathizing loses some of its ability. It happens. It's a thing. It's a thing that Jesus warned us about. It's a thing that Jesus challenged us in. It's a thing that the spiritual journey calls us to give attention to. Now, the danger of having power, the danger of having voice, the danger of having resource, the danger of having privilege, the danger of having citizenship, the danger of being seen, is that we get accustomed to being seen and we get accustomed to having power. And in the accustomedness, we become desensitized. It weakens our ability to see the experience of those who are unlike us. It makes it easier for us to assume that others are dealing with the same world that we are dealing with, and they are not. The danger of power and the danger of voice and the danger of resource and the danger of privilege is that it makes us blind. And so Jesus warned us, and Amos challenged us. Don't let that happen. During World War II, the Dutch were starved by the Nazis. It became known as the famine of 1944-1945. For 2 years, there was this tremendously difficult time where the whole nation was malnourished and many starved to death. In studies after the war, it was discovered that the effects of this significant, this chronic stress, not only affected those who experienced it, but it affected their offspring. And it affected the offspring of their offspring. And significant chronic stress, it turns out, has an epigenetic effect. We've mapped out the genome now, and so we understand these genes will do this and do that. What we don't always understand is there's this chemical wash that comes along through the process that either turns a gene on or turns it off, allows it to express or doesn't express. You can have the breast cancer gene, but if it's not turned on, then it's not as a risk. So there is this process called epigenetics on top of genetics. And it turns out that stress and chronic stress is one of the things that has epigenetic effect. Now, the thing is, that's difficult for any person to see who was not in the situation because epigenetics is just hard to see. You can't see the genealogical effect of a significant stress one generation or two generations ago. And if you can't see it, you can become blind to it. There it is affecting everything, but very difficult for a person who is not affected by it to see. Last month, in the Journal of Biological Psychiatry, there was a published study that had studied several generations of Holocaust survivors' offspring. And the pattern turns out to be the same there. The pattern turns out to be that the stress-related disorders that were carried by those who survived the Holocaust are also carried by their children and also carried by their children's children. In other words, Holocaust-induced stress-related effects showed up in children who weren't even conceived during the Holocaust. So science is giving us a clearer understanding of what Amos is insisting when he says we cannot allow poverty to become a permanent feature in our society. Science is giving us a clearer understanding of Jesus' direct confrontation to the Herodians who were participating with the Romans in the shifting of a culture that had been a returning to ancestral lands to their people every generation. But now we're beginning to take on permanent classes of ownership and not ownership, moving toward sharecroppers and moving toward people who were no longer owners of their own land. Science is giving us even epigenetic language to help us talk about what the ancients discerned a long, long time ago, that allowing one group to suffer gets carried to the children and to the children's children into the third generation. This is something that was discerned already in our scriptures, and we were warned against. But those kinds of things are hard to see. It's very difficult to see how an epigenetic effect is having a cause two generations later. And because they're hard to see, our brains often don't see them. And that makes it easier for our brains to develop the skill set of not seeing. And that makes it easier for our brains not to empathize. It's much easier to dismiss these kinds of things when they are not our day-to-day experience. And so Jesus and Amos warned us, don't let that happen. Now, it could be predicted that poor people get sicker than rich people, not just because of access to health care, but because they're carrying the cumulative effect of chronic stress. Sure enough, I called Laura, who used to work for the Department of Health and Human Services. She says, yeah, and here's a bunch of numbers. And yeah, that's a thing. It really is. Which is, again, it's hard to see if that's not our day-to-day experience. It's hard to feel if it doesn't happen to us. It's easy not to empathize when that is not the environment and the context in which we are living. So, of course, carrying the effects of chronic stress, it's much harder to organize ourselves out of any kind of cycle that would keep us there. Especially when those who have voice and those who have power and who have resource and who have privilege are simply doing what comes naturally to their brains. They're simply seeing what they see and responding to what is their life situation, living in their own experiencing, seeing the world through the lens of their own experience, which is why Amos spoke to the powerful. It's why Amos spoke to the voiced. It's why Amos spoke to the privileged. It's why Amos spoke to the people who live in our county and who live in our zip codes. And he stressed our greater responsibility. And he stressed our greater duty. And he stressed our greater obligation and our demand to engender more sacrifice. He stressed the importance of standing up against our brains and seeing the bigger responsibility that is demanded by having access. Now, in some zip codes, it's hard to see how difficult life can be because everyone around is living the same kind of life. It's very difficult to see it when it's not part of your day-to-day experience because life is very different in those zip codes than it is in others. So Amos tells us what we need to see. You remember when we started this lesson, I say that Amos was able to say what he said because of his job. He had two jobs running two different kinds of crops, and so he was constantly walking the breadth and width of the land and seeing what was going on. He was getting out of his zip code, and he was seeing what was going on in his nation. It was on the context of that seeing and hearing those stories that he stood and he spoke to power, and he said, we cannot allow this to go on. Jesus tells us that we need to see. We need to have eyes that see and ears that hear. Now, in some zip codes, we don't hear the stories of what it's like to live when life is as difficult as life is. But Amos told us, and Jesus tells us, we need to hear those stories because it's in the hearing that our hearts begin to change, that our elephants begin to lean a different way. We need to hear stories about what it's like to live outside of power and what it's like to live outside of visibility and what it's like to live outside of citizenship and what it's like to live outside of health care and what it's like to live outside of family support and financial viability. We need to hear what it's like because these stories are how our hearts change. These stories are how our attitudes change. These stories are how our brains change. It's how we develop what Jesus said, eyes that see. It's how we develop what Jesus called us to, ears that hear. Our religion carries an absolute. It carries a non-negotiable, and it's this. The greatest commandment is love. Love's the bedrock foundation of any moral life. And love that is assigned to us in our tradition is not just for us and for our own. It is, Jesus made it very clear, for our neighbors. And he also made it very clear who our neighbors are. Our neighbors are anyone around us. Our neighbors are the people whose experience is different from our own. Our neighbors are those who live in different zip codes and who have very different experiences of life. Our tradition makes it very clear that love meets the need of the neighbor with the same passion that it meets the need of the self. Our tradition makes it very clear that justice for some that is not extended to all cannot stand. Our tradition makes it very clear that other people are just as much sons and daughters of God as our own sons and daughters are sons and daughters of God. That they merit the same care and the same compassion and the same concern as our own sons and daughters do. Your neighbors are children of God. My neighbors are children of God. And we serve God by serving them. Now, some of us give our volunteer time, give our volunteer energy here in our spiritual community. And that's good that we do that. It's important because the community is the context in which we grow. Some of us help create a healthy spiritual community here, and it is in that context that our lives are transformed. This is where we do the four practices. This is where we become spiritually healthy. But that's not the mandate of our religion. That's the vehicle. The mandate of our religion is to repair the earth. The mandate of our religion is to make things on earth as they are in heaven. That mandate is to be carried to our jobs and to our neighborhoods and to our zip codes and to the zip codes that we don't live in and to the PTA and to the teachers that work with our children and to the police department and to the city council, and to the legislation, and to the food bank, and to win. It's to help us contend for justice and equity and peace and freedom for all of God's children. Our job is to pressure our government officials to behave and to pressure them to balance advantage and disadvantage for all, not simply for our voting bloc. The mandate of love, Amos tells us, is a mandate to work for social solidarity, to work for the well-being of all. Now, to be sure, to do it in sensible ways, and to be sure to do it in empowering ways, and as we've been seeing, to do it with access to all of the moral foundations that happen on the left side of the political spectrum and on the right side of the political spectrum. But what can so easily happen is we see the enormity of the task, we just say, check out, and just vote with my group. That is not an option. Our option is not to not follow the mandate of our religion. We have got lots of options in how we proceed and how we do it. We don't have the option not to take this on. The mandate of love, Amos tells us, is the mandate to work for the social solidarity of all, the well-being of all. But it's to us to stand for those. We live in the zip codes we do. To stand for those without voice and without privilege and who carry greater stress and who have experienced deeper trauma and who have gone under the load of more strain and carry more pressure than we do. That's the message of Amos, and that's the message of Jesus, and that is our religion. And so, Spirit of God, may it be so that that mandate to love is actualized and manifest in us and through us in the world around us. In Jesus' name, amen.